I think I will start with some quick summary of what we talked about last time. So you have worked on this already. So now, like we've seen, like the three different types of possibilities to produce dark matter in the early universe, which leads to the correct abundance in somewhat a natural way. So there's the WIMPs, the thermal dark matter candidates. The freezing, which is another type of thermal dark matter candidate, that get produced early on from like very large densities in the case of the WIMP, and with zero densities to start with in the case of freezing. And then like we talked about also the Michelin mechanism last time, where we show like you can have something that has almost a constant density for a very, very long time. And then, like this particle slowly become dark matter later on. So the discussion of the misalignment draws analogies from the comparison with water molecules and how they slowly settle into a special angle between like the hydrogen and the oxygen atom inside the molecule, and where we see like why the axial mechanism would lead to almost zero amplitude of oscillation of the axion field, while at the same time give you some particle which behaves like dark matter at late time. So as I mentioned before, the QCD axion is a little bit different from this simple misalignment of just like a scalar with a constant mass in the early universe. So in the QCD axion case, the mass actually turns on at some late time during the QCD phase transition. And that fact changes the predictions on the density that we observe today and what type of relations between the mass of and FA like that will give you the right relic abundance. So, as I just checked, you haven't worked on that homework or tutorial yet, but believe me, you will. Okay. So there is a second way where we actually produce the axion and axion dark matter in particular, which is through what is known as a strain or domain wall production. So I'm not going to go into details to talk about this second way of producing it, but just sketch the rough idea. So asking about the second way of production of axions basically goes to the question of where does the axion field actually come from, right? So for all of the discussion we had until now, we treat axion as a field that is a pseudoscalar and has this periodicity before the mass turn on, especially like where there is a flat direction, and then like when the mass turn on, it gets a periodicity of 2 pi FA. So the way that this field arises, just like the pion arises as a phase of the SU2 or SU3 global symmetries here as a Goldstone, and it appears as a field, a phase of a complex scalar field. So this axion, like if you think about the UV, also originate from a complex scalar field, which at late time gets a vacuum expectation value of order FA, just like F pi in the case of the pion. And then, like the axion is going to be the phase of this complex scalar field, right? So what leads to this complex scalar field get a vacuum expectation value of FA is basically spontaneous symmetry breaking. So here, this is a result from spontaneous breaking of U1 global symmetry coming from, let's say, like a Mexican hat-like potential. Okay. So at early time, the universe is very, very hot. All symmetry is restored. The five fields sit in the center. And then at late time, when the temperature is cold enough, the thermal potential, which will go like something like this, disappear. Okay. And from this potential, you realize that the phi wants to be sitting at a minimum, which is at phi equal to FA. So this symmetry breaking is a symmetry breaking of U1 symmetry, which leads to the formation of topological defects especially cosmic strings. Okay, so this dynamics you should have learned in your QFT class. So this formation of these topological defects happens usually in a thermal phase transition, just like when you are boiling water, right? In the water gas phase transition, you see like these bubbles of gas appearing in the water and expand, right? So these are, in that case, in the water gas phase transition, vapor phase transition, you get these bubbles, which are domain walls. And here, in the case when you are breaking a U1, the topological feature tells you that here you are forming cosmic strings. So these cosmic strings, they will evolve. And the evolution itself is a little bit complicated. Eventually, you get to some late time when the axial mass turn on. And when the axial mass turn on, the U1 direction around the string, like this field becomes massive, so you form domain walls. These domain walls will pull these strings together, leads to the annihilation of the string network, which produce all kinds of axions. So this is another way to set up the initial condition for this string domain wall network, which eventually would give you some similar amount of axions at the time of the QCD phase transition, where roughly like you are effectively seeing like order one theta to start with. Okay, so then like you run the dynamics the same way, and eventually you will get another preferred value of the axial mass, which will be 100% of the dark matter if the PQ symmetry was restored in the universe after inflation ends and reheating start. So this is the second way of producing axion dark matter. I'm not going to go into details, they give you a prediction which is very similar to the misalignment. So with all of that, we can write down some general lessons, okay, about dark matter research. And we've talked about, right, like in two lectures, the two general production mechanisms for dark matter. Okay, so the first type is thermal, which includes freeze out and freeze in. So then also you can have non-thermal productions. And here we talked about misalignment. And I roughly sketched these things called basically through topological defects. Okay. So in the case of the thermal production, when we are doing search, right? This is something that we already talked about. In the thermal case, we are talking about searching for the interaction that leads to the production. So the production mechanism, for example, in the case of the freeze-out, tells you a particular mass and the interaction relationship, or like in the case of WIMPs, a particular mass you should be targeting, and you should try to think of every way possible to design experiments that leads to that allows you to look for this dark matter candidate that can be produced with that interaction, right? So in the case of the non-thermal dark matter, of course, the production is through gravitational force. So in that case, I don't know, like I don't have an interaction in particular to search for. But the good thing is like in the case of the misalignment and topological defects, in both cases, they lead to a particular mass of the axion. And axion interaction relationship, right? From both in the QCD axion, from the potential, right? So this is the one where MA times FA is equal to mass of the pion times the pion decay constant. Well, on the other hand, you also get a relationship from dark matter abundance, right? So combining these two, it tells you exact axion mass and axion coupling strength that you should be targeting to, right? So this target is not really like coming from directly as the interaction that produced the particle, but it is still quite closely related. So like these two cases are basically what we generally think are the most attractive or most well-motivated dark matter candidates, because we know we have a reason to believe that they somehow in the early universe gets to the right abundance to be searched for at a late time. And the interaction or some relationship which allows me to produce the dark matter is exactly the same that we are trying to look for with the lab experiments. Okay. So and in the case of the QCD axion, we know very well almost all the interactions this axion can have with all kinds of standard model particles, including the gluons, and as a result, the protons and neutrons, as well as the standard model photon. So today we'll be starting our discussion about how to search for these non-thermal dark matter candidates. So today we'll mostly talk about something like the indirect detection. It will be searching for their effects in astrophysics and particle cosmology. Next lecture we'll be talking about how to actually build experiments to look for these particles. Okay. So So today we'll be talking about how we can use stars as a laboratory. If we are going to spend like time just talking about all kinds of things that we have learned from stars and stellar evolution, it will be, 12, 13 lectures on its own. It tells us about like all kinds of physics, including both in the standard model and also beyond. For example, like most of our information about the neutrinos, at least at in the early days, come from our study of the sun itself. So it also gives the strongest constraint on a lot of particles, especially these light axions and also light bosons that we'll be talking about in the next few lectures. So in this lecture, we'll be talking about general light bosons. So not necessarily axions, which is a pseudoscalar particle. So this is a pseudoscalar. But also particles that can be scalars and also vectors. Okay. So this is the vectors is a massive U1 field. It gets a mass from, for example, a Higgs mechanism. And then like we generally call these things dark photons. The scalars can originate from string theory in the form of dilettantes and moduli. Okay. So all of these particles can potentially be very, very light. And then what they do in both the standard model and the, in beyond standard model sectors is the immediate forces. So since we'll be talking about these light bosons, which are beyond the standard model, the way that we study them is, of course, by thinking of how we study the one bosons that we know in the standard model. And in the standard model, there's one, right? There's the photon. Which is otherwise known as the force carrier of electromagnetism. And when we were learning electromagnetism in high school, we talked about all kinds of properties of the photon. And what are the most important things we learned about the photon? High school. What are the experiments which are most important about the photon? Anything you remember?
You can like scatter from some obstacles and stuff like that, right?
Too complicated.
It's massive.
Electromagnetism. What's the most important thing?
There is a Coulomb law, right?
Huh?
Coulomb law.
Okay, so there's a force, right? Okay, so we have Coulomb, right? And also, like we measure all kinds of spin interactions, all kinds of other interactions coming from magnetic field, right? What else?
Massless.
Huh?
Massless.
Masses, yes. Well, like we can measure the mass from the force, but yes. But like what is the second category other than force? Why does Maxwell like, why do we cherish Maxwell? Why is he important?
It's kind of like freely propagated.
There's also radiation, right? So whenever we study like light particles, we talk about forces and radiation, right? And for radiation, of course, there is we study its emission and the detection, right? Okay, so that's what we do when we that's the most of the important things that we talked about when we talk about the photon. And when we talk about emission, of course, like there are many things which teach us a lot about the universe. We talk about a lot. It's probably the most important radiation in the universe, the CMB, which teaches us almost everything about cosmology. Right. We have stars which are radiating. We measure their photons, and we measure like for example the Balmer lines, the black body spectrum, everything. That's where like quantum mechanics, for example, come from. And we can produce photons in the lab, right? That's what Hertz did, right? Which like test the like the equations that Maxwell write down, right? So these three types of radiation are like radiations that we study for the photon in general. And similarly, we can use these different systems when we are thinking about light bosons beyond, right? So in the case of detection, people are trying to build all kinds of single photon detectors, which are important for both like searches for dark matter and stuff like that, but also like quantum information, because these are basically the device that that is used there too. So so these are all very important things that we are doing with the photon. And similarly, like we should be thinking about how this picture or this table works in the case of the dark photon or dark bosons. Okay, so again, we want to understand the forces, right, and radiation. So the force, there are actually two types of things that we talk about. The first type, we generally call them fifth force experiments. There's a huge amount of those dating back to Cavendish time. Then there are tests of equivalence principle violation. So we'll be talking about these two different types today. We can also talk about the radiation, both the emission and the absorption. Okay. So in the case of the emission, we can talk about cosmology, right? So this is how you sometimes actually produce these particles as dark matter or dark radiation. We already mentioned that. We'll spend a lot of time today talking about stars and why we should think about the stars as a lab for testing these light bosons. And then, like there are these things called the light through wall experiments, okay, which basically you are shining a very strong laser at the wall. You know that the standard model photon they interact electromagnetically, they get stopped at the wall, right? But like if you have new light bosons, these particles can penetrate the wall and convert back to the photon on the other side. And there are a lot of these experiments which provide sensitive probes of all kinds of dark bosons. So we might say something about this at the last lecture, but today we'll be focusing on the forces and the stars. Okay, and tomorrow on Wednesday, most of the discussion about will be about the absorption, which is otherwise known as how to build experiment. So that's the plan. Okay. Top. Okay. So that's the plan. So let's see. What do we mean by fifth force, and what do we mean by EP violation? So in the case of the axion, the forces were first worked out by Moody and Wilczek. Okay. So there they listed all kinds of new fifth forces which can exist because of the axion and because of also other beyond standard model particles. And in terms of Lagrangian, right, you can write down basically how this scalar or pseudoscalar interact with the standard model fermions, which we call psi. So for example, like this particle can interact so just like similar to a Higgs if it is a scalar. Okay, so this is a scalar interaction. While it can also interact like a pseudoscalar. In this case, the pseudoscalar has a shift symmetry. So this is the leading operator you can write down. Okay, so generally, like we actually have a very high precision measurement of these forces. So like these couplings are usually really, really tiny. So this is what we write down usually, like to start with. But these are usually not very useful because these are couplings in the ultraviolet, right? And while relating how this this particle and its interaction to the standard model particles as some Dirac or like wire spinners. What is more useful, like experimentally, is going to the non-relativist limit, right? And what the scalar does is basically it couples this scalar field to the so here like the number density of the standard model particles. While on the right hand side, this leads to an interaction between the gradient of the field coupled to the spin of the fermionic state. Okay. So this is a little bit abstract. This is much simpler to think about. So now, when we are writing down the fifth force, basically we are interested in the interaction between like these two fermions or two blobs of fermions by this scalar field phi, right? Okay, with a mass m phi through either the scalar or the pseudoscalar interaction. Okay. And you can from this easily find. Okay, so this this interaction is just like the gravitational interaction, just mediated by a scalar. So it's always attractive. This is a interaction with the spin. So now, like at order g squared, you can find the interaction mediated by the scalar. Should have a potential that goes as 1 over r. But of course, like now I'm talking about a force mediator which has a mass. So it has a Yukawa type of potential with a force range order 1 over m of the scalar field. Well, you can also get a pseudoscalar interaction. So now this is an interaction which is proportional to the spin of the system. Okay, so this is like a magnetic interaction. So the potential goes as 1 over r squared in the limit of zero mass. Okay. You can find terms that are proportional to g pseudoscalar squared, and then like those interactions will go even higher order of 1 over r. Okay, so but today we'll mostly be talking about this one. Okay, and how to look for this force. So first, the question is, so now question is for you. Should I use two atoms or two like molecules in a lab to measure this force, or should we use something else? What type of system should I use to measure a force of this kind?
It's something which has big charge, right?
Okay. So good. So the reason is because this force, right? The competition is always against the electromagnetism, and luckily there's both positive and negative charged particles. So on a large scale, right, like the electromagnetic force is not there. So this force here is always attractive, right? So we should use like as big object as possible, so that we can gain factors like Avogadro number squared, right, or the stellar mass, like some very heavy object. Good. So then since like this force has a range, we should be thinking of objects which are separated by a range that is like in comparison with the range of the force. Okay. So now we are thinking about two big objects. Okay. They are separated by a range R. So if this range R is smaller, so let's say like this is the one over m phi. So if R is much smaller than one over m phi, right, then this factor is no longer important. I basically have a one over R potential. All right. So then the force goes as 1 over r squared. If r is much bigger than 1 over m phi, of course, this exponential factor is more relevant. So now the force is mostly set by this e to the minus mr, right? So for any two objects which is separated by r naught, I would expect the sensitivity, right, of this force to have a feature at this location 1 over m phi, right? And generally, I should have my sensitivity on this scalar coupling GS squared to have some feature like this. Okay, so if the mass is very heavy, or otherwise Compton wavelength of this particle is very very small, then you are in this regime, right? The force is exponentially suppressed. So in order for you to get like a force which is measurable or you are sensitive to, you want like a very large coupling to start with. So that's why like you see this exponential decrease of the sensitivity when you are at having masses that are heavier than 1 over r naught. On the other hand, for any of this object, if the particle is very, very light, so the mass is zero and this wavelength is infinite, then basically we are left with this force here. And the sensitivity to the strength of the coupling should roughly stay a constant, right? So this, in an empty universe, right, in a universe where I only have this scalar field, which is mediating a force, then generally when I perform an experiment with a fixed sensitivity on the force, I should have plotted a curve like this, right? But is this true?
Yeah,
generally, this is not what we see when we see like this sensitivity curves. What we actually see is usually something like this. Okay, where as your particle becomes lighter and lighter, the sensitivity of a particular system actually decreases. So why is that? So what is the other force which scales like this? Huh? Gravity, right? Okay. So if you have two objects, right? Like let's say like a sun and the Earth, and we are trying to measure like the Earth and the Moon, we are trying to measure this force and we are trying to measure acceleration. We don't know like whether this acceleration is coming from this new force or the gravity. And usually I cannot really count all the protons that is on the Earth. There's no way I can independently like weigh the Earth or weigh the Moon, right? So I cannot go and count like say, oh, there are 10 to the 50 protons on the Moon. I cannot measure it to 10% precision. So if like this new force carrier gives you a force which parametrically scales exactly the same way as gravity, then you cannot distinguish whether the effect you are measuring is coming from this new force or gravity, right? Especially when this interaction strength is much weaker than gravity. So instead, we need to look for features, right, which makes this force a little bit different compared to gravity. So the way we do it, right, at when like a lambda phi is very large, okay, when m phi small, is I take the exponential, right, and expand, right? Okay, so this goes as 1 minus m phi r. Okay, maybe like a plus. Okay, so is this something that is measurable? Yes, no.
Expecting m, I'm a little confused. You're expecting m to be very, very light, no?
Yeah, m is very, very small. So I'm just Taylor expanding my exponential. We just talked about the 1, right? 1 is what gives you 1 over r squared. I cannot distinguish this 1 from gravity, right? Is this measurable?
I mean, yes, it goes with 1 over r.
Yes or no?
Yes.
It's being very tricky.
So like what is V of phi? So V of phi is 1 over r times e to the minus mr, right? So is this second term measurable? No? Right, because like the r cancels this 1 over r here, right? So this leads to a potential, which is a constant. It doesn't give you a force, right? So the leading effect is coming from this term, which distinguishes your force from gravity. And that is why, like when you when you plot like a gs squared, like the sensitivity, you always go down at light masses, and this usually scales as m phi squared. Okay, so the lighter it is, the worse the sensitivity is. Okay, so this is a fifth force, right? But In principle, we can do better. Okay, and usually in the lab, the curves that we for real astrophysical object, this is usually like the curve that we see. But in the lab, we can actually do better. We usually don't need to pay this for suppression. Okay, so and that leads us to the second type of search, which is called equivalence principle violation test. So usually, like no matter when you have, as long as you are having a force which is not totally gravity, and you cannot really mimic gravity with a scalar interaction, the interaction will violate equivalence principle, right? So for example, for these general scalars which couple to the standard model, it will have a different coupling to protons and the neutrons. So what that means is if I can totally control the two objects that I'm measuring the force between, then I can use this composition dependence to separate the force, which looks like gravity, and this new force, which doesn't look like gravity. So so one type of equivalence principle violation test is done by the great Galileo when he was dropping stuff from the Pisa Tower, right? And people are doing this experiment still until today, but just with like an enormous precision, okay? So this there is some experiment called atom interferometry. And then, like, there is a second type of experiments which does perform a similar test using like torsion balances. So there, like, they are just trying to do the Cavendish experiment, but with like objects that are made of different materials. So it's very similar to in this case. So let's just talk about the experiments with atom interferometry. So the idea here, so this is an experiment which is done like very recently, is by dropping two isotopes of rubidium. Okay, so you are dropping rubidium 87 and rubidium 85. Okay, so both of them carries 27 protons. Okay, but one of them carry 50 neutrons, the other one carry 48 of them. Okay, so you have a 10 meter tower, let's say. And you are dropping them to see if they arrive on Earth at the same time, basically. Okay, so let's say like I have a force which interacts differently between like a neutron and proton, and mostly just interact with the neutrons, let's say. Then the force is proportional to n, right? Well, the mass is proportional to p plus n. So then I will get eventually an acceleration of which goes as n over p plus n. And since like these two elements has different neutron number with the same proton number, then these two things will drop at a different speed, right? So if we measure that they arrive on the Earth at the same time, then we know that there's not this force which violates the equivalence principle, which will make these two isotopes drop differently. And since these usually, like for two isotopes, we can find two particles which has this ratio. So like a delta A will go as a delta N over P plus N. This is roughly like a few percent. Okay, we can instead of pay like this m squared penalty, we can pay like this penalty of a few percent. Okay, so in a lab experiment, usually instead of having a shape like the orange line, we can do a shape which goes something like this. Where here we are paying the penalty of a similar chemical composition. And usually, of course, it is better to pay this one or few percent penalty instead of paying like the full penalty of 1 over m squared. Okay, so this is one type of equivalence principle test. So the reason like we choose like these the isotopes of the same element is both experimental and theoretical. So the like on the very experimental side, like we choose like these different isotopes because they are usually like the optical transitions, which allows me to control one is the same as the ones that will allow me to control the other. On the other hand, like or similar to the ones that will allow me to control the other, on the theoretical side is like if I'm using like two elements with the same proton number, then their electromagnetic interaction is exactly the same, right? So I can do, compute like their properties when they drop with the same electromagnetic corrections to all the processes that we not necessarily know like exactly how to model, and then like be left with just this difference of the neutron number, which is the only thing that can lead to this difference in time of arrival at the bottom, right? So so this is one type of equivalence principle violation test. And generally, we have been using like a lot of this to test the existence of new force carriers, new light bosons, okay? So and to give you an idea of like how strong like this constraint might be. So at some points, the best precision we can get is roughly 10 to the minus 11 times the strength of the gravity, gravitational force, okay? So the both like from like a measurement of the Moon's orbit, this is called a lunar laser ranging experiments, but also lab-based like torsion balance experiments. So we know like there are no force carrier, which is carrying a force that is stronger in some range of masses than 10 to the minus 11 of gravity. And we generally usually think of gravity as a really, really weak force. And that tells you like really like the strength of these experiments and what this experimental is. So these are the force experiments. All right, so then we will talk a little bit about radiation, okay, and especially radiations from stars. Okay, so as we already talked about, so in this case, we are trying to look for a force carrier. So in the case of the force, we are usually trying to measure this interaction, okay? So that we can take full advantage of the Avogadro number of particles and measure a force that is 11 order magnitude weaker than gravity, for example. So in the case of the radiation, usually we are trying to look for this interaction. So this is an interaction that, for example, the QC axion will mediate. And we know that in the case of the QC axion, the coupling strength we want to be sensitive to, right, like this G, is order like a 1 over 10 to the 10 or 10 to the 11 GeV. Okay, so these are really, really weak interactions that we are trying to look for, especially like when you compare this interaction strength with electromagnetism. Okay, so here, so this is to search for for example, the pseudoscalar interactions. And here we'll be mostly talking about this interaction. Okay. Between axions and photons. Okay, so this is the Hodge dual of the photon, F tilde, and the F. So you should think of it in the non-tested limit as basically the electric field dotting into the magnetic field of the axion, of the photon. And and this interaction strength here, which and usually we call this thing together, GA gamma gamma, can be as small as 10 to the minus 12. GeV inverse. Okay, so when we look at such an interaction strength, it is certainly much, much weaker than the interaction strength of the photon. But still, we can use a star to look for the existence of this particle. Okay, so. And these searches are usually called searches for stellar cooling. Okay. And my claim, somewhat surprising, is for particles, even with this small strength of interaction with the standard model photon, or like 10 minus 10, it will significantly affect how the sun cools. Okay, so it is so much weaker than the main cooling mechanism of the sun, which is emission of photons. Right. So why is that? Right. So something, an axion with about 30%, I think. 10 to 30% is the amount okay. So this is the statement. So why is this even possible? Any guesses? Okay. So where does the photon cool? Where does the photon we see from the sun come from? Does it come from here? Or does it only come from here? Huh?
It's from everywhere.
Is it coming from everywhere?
I don't know if the light can like escape from the core, right?
Right. Okay. So, what is the parameter which determines where the light comes from?
It's the same. It's the same factor. Like we used all the time, except now there's no hub. You have to have something else. So
what is the parameter that matters? Optics. So we need to understand what is the optical depth, right? So the optical depth tells you like how far, like a photon, like basically like it's a mean free pass. It's another way of saying the mean free pass. It's like how much like the photon can propagate between before like it just gets either absorbed or scattered and loses energy, right? So for a photon, of course, it scatters a lot. Okay, so let's say like I have a photon, and it is scattering with the Thomson cross section, right? Just from electromagnetism, right? So the cross section goes as alpha squared over me squared, right? Roughly. So and then like we know the number density of electron right, in the star. It's all mostly ionized, right? The star is very hot, it's all ionized. And this is, as we already talked about last time, it's roughly KeVQ, right? So if you ask the distance the photon can travel, which is basically NE times sigma, right? 1 over NE times sigma. What I get is KeV squared. So I have alpha in the denominator, so it's like 0.01 squared. ME is MeV squared, right? Cubed. So this is 1 over KeV, which is roughly a nanometer. I have 10 to the 6, 4, right? So 10 to the 10, right? So this is roughly 10 meters or a few meters. Okay. So what it tells you is like if I take a photon and I like somebody like send it out from like this here, it travels 10 meters and it stopped. So in order for it to go all the way to the surface of the sun, right? So the size of the sun, do you know what's the radius of the sun? Anyway. So this is roughly one light second, okay? So it's something like 10 to the 10 meter, 10 to the 10 centimeter, or 10 to the 8, 10 to the 9 meters, let's say. So in order for you, with a mean free pass of 10 meter, to go all the way to 10 to the 10 to the 9 meter, right? You are suppressed by like exponential over time minus 8, right? 10 to the 8. And that never happens, right? So basically like these photons, they're bouncing around inside. And only like the very, very small amount near the surface of order 10 meters, these photons has a chance of escaping, right? So if you compute like the ratio of L over R solar, this is roughly a size of 10 minus 8, right? So though like the star can emit photon from everywhere, only this 10 to the minus 8 or like a total volume of the star is actually emitting photons that we can see, right? And it is emitting at a temperature of basically 6,000 Kelvin, which is the black body temperature of the emission that we are seeing. Okay. So, what about the what about a dark boson? Well, this in principle can because it interacts very, very weakly. Once it gets emitted, it doesn't really scatter anymore, so it goes all the way out, right? So these can actually come from even from the center of the object. So let's say like we are talking about these particles, which can scatter with either the photon or the electron. Then this quantity doesn't change very much, right? This quantity, of course, depends on the interaction strength, but as you can see, the emission from the star is let's see, total emission scales as the production is proportional to a cross section, right? Well, the optical depths are like this L. Which is how deep this photon can come from, goes as 1 over sigma, right? So when you combine the two, the emission power, which goes as the sigma times L, is actually independent of sigma for a very long time, right? So even if the cross-section, as we know from here, is 8 at orders of magnitude smaller, the emission of this particle, is, if like the star is totally uniform in temperature, is exactly the same. Okay, so for sigma that is 10 to minus 8 of like the Thompson cross section, we get the same emission. from the sound. Okay. So this means like it is possible that a dark boson, which has a much weaker interaction strength compared to the standard model photon, can be potentially emit at the same rate. Right? The thing gets even better. Okay, so this is one. The second thing is, of course, the sun, the star, is not all the same temperature throughout. Right? The surface is much colder. The core is much hotter, right? So we know that the sun at its core has temperatures that are bigger or comparable to a KeV, right? So with the same volume or same material, if the like the emission goes as a temperature to the fourth power, right? Sigma the black body emission, then if I have like emissions coming from the core, it will be emitted at a rate that is roughly like a 12 order magnitude bigger compared to the rate which is emitted on the surface. Right? It's true for the photon as well, just these photons cannot escape all the way, while the dark bosons, which gets emitted at this temperature, will be escaping like much further. So for the axion, because of the interaction here is a durative interaction, right? So it is emit. This is a total derivative. So the interaction is total derivative interaction. It has even a stronger dependence on the temperature of the material that is emitting it. So this means that for the axion, most of the emission is actually coming from the center, and they are emitting with a much much bigger power than what would be like on the surface, right? So this T core over T surface, okay, which is order like 10 to the 3 or 10 to the 4, is another factor that needs to be taken into account when we are computing like how much dark bosons are emitted from the star. So with these two effects taken into account, we can get what is known as the solar cooling bound. Okay, so and let me just draw a plot, and we'll end. So the solar cooling bound usually has this form. So I have the mass of the particle we are looking at, and I have the coupling strength, let's say GA gamma gamma, and going down is weaker interaction. Okay. And these bounds usually look like this. Okay, so here, like I plotted one from the sun, and then another one from the supernova. Okay, so so this will be something like a supernova 1987A, and this will be from the sun. Okay, so first you see that the constraint is as strong. It's basically like the same strength when you go to lower and lower masses. Okay, and the reason is because like the temperature is much bigger than the mass. When the temperature is much bigger than the mass of the particle, then you are basically emitting a massless particle, and the sensitivity is independent of the mass. Okay, so that's the this is excluded, but they usually at some point like has a change of behavior, and that happens when the MA is comparable to the temperature of core of the object, right? So in the case of the sun, like this happens at around a KeV. The supernova is much hotter, so like this transition happens at MeVs. So and this transition is basically coming from the exponential of the mass of the axion over the temperature of the object, okay? And which is why like it has a curve like this. Okay, so usually when we are designing experiment, the two type of plots we are competing against or trying to beat is this one and that one. Okay, so this one tells you like basically what is the force strength that this particle will emit, like will mediate between two objects that we know. Okay, And if you are designing experiments, especially a dark matter experiment, which has a sensitivity which are weaker than these limits, then you are not probing new parameter space. Similarly here, right? Like if you are when you are designing an experiment to look for like some dark matter properties of the, dark matter axions, and if like the sensitivity is weaker than the Cooling bound, then you are not looking for anything either. And so like this limit has been done like for a lot of beyond standard model scenarios, but not all. And many of the things people talk about, sometimes even in the literature, does not like agree with either of the Cooling bound or the force bound. And so, these are usually when you are thinking about a BSM model, these are the first two things that you try to compare to and see if the model is already excluded. Okay, so because like you know, like looking for something in the lab, seeing something in the lab, while knowing that the same physics will like make the sun like totally blow up like in 5 hours, is not something that that is reasonable to do. So so that's most of the discussion about the force and the radiation measurements one can do with the stars. And tomorrow we'll be talking about knowing this constraint, how do we design like a really, really sensitive experiments which can beat this constraint if these particles are dark matter, how we can look for a force carrier that couples with 11 order magnitude weaker than gravitational strength. That's possible. And also like to look for some particles with really, really weak interactions with that will not be emitted by stars. So that's it. See you next time.